Good afternoon. I want to welcome the intrepid among you who ventured out in the ice and snow, and I think it's mostly rain, to come here. My name is John Alterman. I run the Middle East program here, and it is a special pleasure to welcome Joost Hilterman here today. I think it is hard to have been working in the Middle East field in the last 15 years and not been tremendously impressed with Joost's work. He worked for 5 years for Al-Haq in Ramallah, then spent 10 years with Human Rights Watch, covering Middle East issues, arms control issues, and then has spent about 5 years with International Crisis Group, resident in the Middle East. He has written, I think, insightfully, persuasively, not only about arms control issues in the Middle East, human rights issues, and he has played a significant and central role in the crisis group's really superb reporting on Iraq over the last several years. I think it is not any sort of overstatement to say that there is a centrality to the crisis group's reports, because the crisis group gives insight and analysis with a depth and level of sophistication that really nobody else is doing. I know certainly in the open source literature and perhaps in the classified world as well, and we're I think all in your debt. Joost is here, and he's going to talk to us about something we haven't heard that much about, but I think a lot of people have imputed knowledge about, which is how everything going on in Iraq affects what's happening in the rest of the Gulf. You have small and insecure countries who are generally worried by what's happening in a large and insecure country that makes them feel even more insecure. Joost comes to this not as a Gulf expert, so much as somebody who understands deeply what's happening in Iraq, understands the integration of events in Iraq with what's happening in the rest of the region. He will talk, I think, mostly from an Iraqi perspective. He's currently based in Istanbul. And then we'll talk for a while, and then we'll open up to questions. So I give you Joost Hilterman. Thank you.
Well, thank you, John. Those were very generous comments. I'd like to think that the International Crisis Group has some influence on the way things are going in Iraq, but I must say that for 5 years...
It's your fault.
Yeah, I know. For 5 years, we were close to despair, because, or 4 years, four years, yes, I guess, because we thought we had a fairly good grip on the situation, but we didn't see American power having a good grip on the situation, and things got progressively worse, of course, as we know. And now, finally, we see, a very strong team on the ground that seems to be doing things that you could call the right things, even if they are problematic in other ways. And I'm talking about the Arab Awakening, for example, useful in pushing back Al-Qaeda, and who could not applaud that, but problematic because support of tribes in Iraq has a long history and is viewed with suspicion by urban Iraqis, and the majority of Iraqis are urban. And the tribes are notoriously hard to unify, organize, mobilize, other than around very parochial agendas. So here I'm already criticizing it. On the other hand, I see that some progress has been made, that relative quiet has been restored to Anbar, where nobody a year ago believed this would be possible. And I just was at a conference where one of the generals who was in charge of Anbar spoke, who was very, very happy about the accomplishments there, talking about exporting the model. Now, this is where immediately we would part ways. It's one thing to accomplish something in Anbar. It's another thing to say, well, no, we should do the same thing with the Shiite tribes, because even if a model works, it doesn't mean it's applicable to other parts of Iraq. So we have, in sum, we have a long way to go, and there are many things that are unresolved, but political space is being created in Iraq. And this is critically important. The question now is, will it be exploited properly? Will it be used to stabilize the situation? This can only be done through politics, cannot be done only by military means. But this is conventional wisdom. You know, General Petraeus has been saying the same thing, Ambassador Crocker and others. So we all know that. And the question is, how do we do that? That is, how do we get from here to there? But what the surge has done, essentially, is create a breathing space. for ordinary Iraqis who are delighted that now they can go out in the streets fairly safely. And I have to say that one of my colleagues who's on the ground told me that actually kidnappings for criminal reasons have gone up, not down. So there remains a problem of the police not being effective in fighting crime. But at the political level, in terms of political violence, things have changed dramatically for now. And that is, of course, of a great relief to ordinary Iraqis in Baghdad who were, even if they were still living in mixed neighborhoods, and I would like to emphasize that most Iraqis in Baghdad were still living in mixed neighborhoods, despite all the news you heard about a sectarian cleansing, that they were chafing under the rule of militias or insurgent groups, military actors who were lording it over them, who were driving out people regardless of whether they were Sunnis or Shiites. There are many cases, for example, where Sunni groups were actively recruiting among the Sunni population of a certain neighborhood. And of course, this was driving out the middle class. They didn't want to see their sons disappear in shadowy groups with very uncertain prospects and to be countered by American force, for example, or by Shiite militia. So this has led to the refugee crisis and the IDP crisis that we have seen. So this, even though we have seen no reversal of that yet, we have seen a freeze in this. And so these are important developments inside Iraq. I think today, this morning, I heard an announcement that Muqtada Sadr has decided to renew his ceasefire for 6 months. Yesterday I was saying, well, I don't know if he's going to publicly renew it, but strategically this is what he needs to do, and what he would do, what he will do, because he has no interest in confronting American power. He can wait out the storm, wait for the Americans to leave, which sooner or later they have to, and then Sadr will be looking very strong and has a chance to settle accounts with some of his immediate adversaries, especially on the Shiite side, also on the Sunni side. But so now he's actually formally renewed the ceasefire, which is very significant. And also, maybe this reflects the different posture in the U.S. Military approach to the Sadrists. I think you may have seen the piece in the Washington Post yesterday that suggested that the Americans now are quite happy with the Sadrists, see them as responsible actors, see them as genuinely trying to clean ship, getting rid of loose elements, etc., etc., and that this is a basis for working with them, because in the future, but you cannot defeat them. I think there's a realization that you cannot defeat a popular movement, and they have played a political game, and quite well, for a long time. It's because of the Sadrists that we have the Maliki government. That was a compromise between the Sadrists and the Supreme Council. Without that, we would have had an entirely different government. The Sadrists have played a balancing role in that way, for good or for bad. That's a different argument. But they have played an interesting political role. And they seem to continue to want to play that. Whether they will demobilize their militia is an entirely different question, and that is still, there's still a ways to go. And I think much will depend on what the Americans are going to do in Iraq. Now, we come to the neighboring states. And this is, of course, the subject of today's presentation. John already, and I'm very grateful to him for saying it, I'm not a Gulf expert. I am not very, will not be of much help when it comes to the GCC. But as an organization, we've been focused very much on not only Iraq, but also in Iran and Saudi Arabia. And so, close enough, that's Gulf. I'd be happy to talk about that a bit. And if you don't mind, or we can do it in question and answers, there's also a little bit talk about, you know, what was happening yesterday and today in Turkey with the incursion. So my interest is really in talking about the neighboring states of Iraq. And the lowest common denominator, where all the neighboring states have something in agreement about Iraq, is that none of them want Iraq to fall apart. And then everything from there probably differs. Some states would want Iraq to remain weak. Some would want it to remain friendly. I guess maybe everybody would want it to remain friendly. But there are real concerns that Iraq is in fact not friendly. For example, Saudi Arabia and Jordan have those concerns. Some of the Gulf states as well. A country without weapons of mass destruction. And a country that will not give in to centrifugal forces and fall apart as a result of an American withdrawal. And this, even Iran, I would put in that category. I remember a couple of months ago or so, there was this bold statement by Ahmadinejad, who came you know, in front of the cameras and said, well, you know, if the Americans leave, we're ready to step into the vacuum, you know, and stabilize Iraq. And I couldn't help but think that he just came out of an Iranian security meeting in which the prospect of an American withdrawal was discussed and everybody expressing great concern about an early American withdrawal. And then Ahmadinejad thinks he can sort of with typical bravado make a point, but the opposite one. I think for Iran it is very dangerous if the United States were to withdraw its forces without first stabilizing the country to a certain degree. And it can only stabilize the country by filling the vacuum that it had left, well, that it created in 2003 and that it's been trying to fill by building up Iraqi security forces, by establishing an Iraqi government, by building up a managerial class. But the mistakes of 2003 were so fundamental that this is a long-term project. And so everybody in the entire neighborhood is very concerned about what is going to happen with this huge vacuum, and for better or for worse, and despite all the mistakes that have been made, the United States forces have filled that vacuum. And so countries that were against the American invasion, and I think that includes just about every neighbor, now are hesitant to embrace any kind of quick withdrawal. In fact, none of them take that position, and I would argue that Iran is one of them. Clearly, the Arab states, who were very much against this war, who wanted to find alternative solutions to the Saddam problem, were trying to find a face-saving way out for him, who were promised by the Bush administration that this would be short and sweet, and there was nothing to worry about. Well, their worst nightmares came true in 2005, 2006, when the war clearly was everything but so short and sweet, and the country seemed to be spinning out of control, and possibly might even break up. So now everybody is looking at the search and say, "Well, we told you so. You know, this is what we've been advocating all along. You need to talk to the Arabs, to this," and I mean, of course, the Sunni Arabs, not the Shiite Arabs. They don't trust the Shiite Arabs. They call them proxies of Iran. They may find some good ones among them. Alawi is a notable example. It's the kind of Shiite Arab that Arab states like. He's a security man. He's a secular guy. He's basically a Saddam without the name Saddam. And this is very heartening to the Arab states. They've been trying to promote him, but he's not getting anywhere. He has no traction inside Iraq. And but so what do they have now is the Sunni Arabs. And this is they've been begging the Americans essentially to hold out to the Sunni Arabs. So two main reasons: one, because of the perceived advances that Iran was making, and keep in mind that you know, there once was such a thing as the Iran-Iraq War, in which the Arab states fought Iran by proxy, and the proxy was Iraq. But now Iraq is gone, essentially. It cannot fight that war. It cannot be that buffer against Iranian expansionism and its attempt to establish hegemony in the Gulf. And so it needs something else. And so that is one main thing. It needs now, if the U.S. is going to leave, it needs to have a buffer. Now, the Arab forces, the Sunni Arabs in Iraq, didn't perform very well in 2005. They were pushed on the defensive. The Shiite militias were pushing them out. And they were still in some, you know, hanging on for dear life in some Baghdad neighborhoods. Of course, they're in Anbar, but they were being challenged everywhere else, in Diyala and Salahuddin, other mixed governorates, also in places like Tel Afar and in Mosul. So this was a very serious threat to them. The other issue, of course, was Al-Qaeda. And paradoxically, probably, I mean, this is typical of politics, Al-Qaeda was, in a way, doing the Arab states' bidding. I'm not saying the Arab states were supporting Al-Qaeda. I doubt very much they were doing that, even though Al-Qaeda clearly had deep pockets and money must have come from the Gulf. It's hard to imagine where else it could have come from, but I don't have evidence, of course. But that's the assumption. It has to be the assumption. But Al-Qaeda was, so on the one hand, was doing the good work, keeping a dam against the Iranian advances. On the other hand, they were provoking the Iranians or the Iranian proxies. This is the perception, of course. The Shiite militias, the Shiite government-led government in Baghdad, provoking them. And of course, there's always the risk, especially if you build them up, that they come back and start focusing on the real, what is for them the real enemy. And the real enemy, of course, is authoritarian Arab regimes, secular regimes, ungodly regimes, whatever you want to call them. And so The surge, I mean, sort of the recognition on the part of the United States that things have gotten out of hand and this would be a threat to strategic U.S. interests, helped Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, Jordan, less so Syria, of course, as Arab states, in that now they had an opportunity to support the good Arabs in Iraq, the nationalist Arabs, the Sunni nationalist Arabs, who would fight both Al-Qaeda now, and, because they cannot do that openly now, fight Iran, but to find some time and space to build up the forces so that if or when U.S. forces withdraw and things have not been settled in Iraq, then there is an effective buffer against further Iranian expansionism. And so today, the Sahwa Awakening Councils, the concerned citizen groups, the Sons of Iraq, whatever you want to call them, whatever they call themselves, whatever the Americans call them, these are allies. These are an important factor for the neighboring Arab states. And much now depends on what will happen next. So where before, you know, these states were essentially shitting bricks, essentially, because they were so afraid that the Iranians were winning through elections, through military power, through everything, and helped by the Americans, mysteriously. Now, they're still sitting tight, but they can breathe a sigh of relief because America finally seems to be doing the right thing. Just spoke with, you know, an official in Turkey who said, you know, Turkish perspective is exactly the same. We told the Americans all along, talk to the Sunnis, and they thought that we were saying that because we want to keep the Kurds down. No, we want them to keep Iraq together. This is what we want. We are very worried. Our strategic interest is to have in Iraq that stays together. We can talk about internal arrangements and exactly what kind of federalism this is going to be. Frankly, we don't like this federalism business, but we can live with certain forms of that. But the key is that the country stays together. And now the Americans finally have seen the light and they're doing it. They're doing the right thing. And I think the signs are everywhere, and this is what is reinforcing these countries, these governments, in their notion that the Americans are doing the right thing. Even the incursion today, and yesterday is showing that, because how can Turkish forces enter Iraqi territory as long as U.S. forces are on the ground? They must have given the green light. They have given the green light. Not only are they giving the green light, they're sharing intelligence. So this, for the Kurds in Iraq, this is only a signal that the Americans are changing their posture with respect to the Kurds. Another sign of that is the agreement that was reached in Kirkuk at the local level on December 2nd, when an agreement was signed between the Kurdish parties and the Arab parties. And this was only because the Arabs in Kirkuk had just set up an awakening council in Hawija, which had been the center of Al-Qaeda's attacks inside Kirkuk. These attacks have ended. They've stopped, more or less. Al-Qaeda has been pushed on the defensive. But the Arabs weren't going to do something there if they didn't get something in return. The quid pro quo was, please rein in the Kurds and their expansionist designs. They want to grab Kirkuk, but Kirkuk is ours as well. And so, or maybe the Arabs would say it's all only ours, but there's a problem there too. But there's a clash of nationalisms there, Arab and Kurdish nationalism, even Turkish nationalism. And so the signal is now clear that the tide is turning, and it's turning in favor of the Sunni Arabs. They themselves keenly have this sense. I was a couple of weeks ago at the Kirkuk Governorate Council, and the Arab leaders there, the new deputy governor, they have a sense of empowerment. You know, things are going to change. We feel it in the air. There's going to be provincial elections. This means that now the Arabs and the Turkmens, we will vote, you know, in full and turn out to be a two-thirds majority against the Kurds. Just let's show them. I don't think it's going to be that easy. But in any case, that is their feeling. And this is also a reciprocal process between the Arab states and their allies inside Iraq. The sense that the United States is doing the right thing, and there are signs on the ground that this is happening, and so everybody is reinforcing each other. We're now finally starting to settle things. But what's the end game? Where is this going to go? If the United States is intent on pulling back its forces, of course it is pulling back some forces already, we're going to be back at pre-surge levels by July, what is going to happen? Will Will the U.S. be able to continue to fill that vacuum until the Iraqis can fill it effectively by political power, military power, etc., managerial power? If they are going to withdraw, it is very unlikely, in my view, that this situation can last. And then I think it's very likely that there will be a re-escalation of the civil war. And then I think it's very likely that the Arab states and Iran will be facing each other directly, first through their proxies inside Iraq, but eventually directly. And then what's going to happen? The Iranians have all kinds of advantages in numbers, and they showed it in the Iran-Iraq war as well, in military power. The Saudis, they buy stuff off the shelf. They're not fighters. So they'll have to buy somebody to do the fighting for them. It's going to be very difficult. And that will bring the United States back in. It makes no sense. I was at a conference. There were a number of American military leaders. Their view is that we're in here for the long haul. There is not going to be any significant withdrawal anytime soon. And this is the only way we can stabilize Iraq. So these are the stark choices that we face. And if you ask any of the neighboring states, including Iran, I think the answer is good. You know, you're going to ask them, what should the United States do? I think all of them except Iran will say, the United States should stay. Iran say, okay, they have got to leave. But meanwhile, they're thinking, please let them stay. Because we cannot afford to step into this vacuum, to be sucked into this vacuum right now. The Iranians are in a bind because they, on the one hand, they are very happy that the regime has been removed, even by American power. Of course, they were not in favor of the Americans doing it, but they're happy that the regime is gone. They were happy that the Americans organized the elections. It brought their friends to power. They're not great friends, but compared to everybody else, this was the best they could get. But the problem is now they have all these American forces right on the ground near them. That was bad. What was good was the Americans messed it up. They failed. I remember being in Iran before the war, and they were worried about the Americans coming into Iraq, being surrounded by the Americans or pro-American regimes in the region. You can imagine sitting in Tehran and looking around, and Americans are everywhere. But now they look at things, they're very comfortable. Why worry? The only thing they worry about is if the Americans leave. That's quite a turnaround. So that's where we are today. And I think it is totally undecided where this is going to go. We have elections coming up in this country. I doubt very much that any of the candidates will be able to pull out American forces anytime soon in any significant numbers. That's a prediction, not a recommendation. We have elections next month in Iran for parliament, which may bring a shift from the new conservatives that are represented by Ahmadinejad to the old conservatives, or it may not. Or it may be undecided and remain murky for a while. And importantly, we're going to have elections inside Iraq, maybe. They have been scheduled now for no later than October 1st at the provincial level, and they should take place as well at the national level, parliament, before the end of 2009. So all of these are going to create imponderable situations, and we'll have to see where it goes next. But at least there's a breathing space, and this we cannot afford not to use it to the fullest to restabilize the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joost. One of the questions that was running through my mind as you were giving that very impressive analysis was this question of the Sunni Arab states' relationship to the Shia central government in Baghdad, and the sense that I have that they really don't want to deal with the Shia central government, and a sense also over the last couple of years that the central government is less and less in control, or even hoping to be in control, of what's happening in the provinces, and that while many of the Sunni states have deep relationships with Sunni tribes and developing relationships with many of the Sunni provinces, that the sort of normalization of the Iraqi national role in the region not only doesn't seem near, but doesn't even seem in prospect. Could you talk a little bit about that relationship of the center and the periphery, and whether you think it is going to be an objective of some of these governments to simply continue to ignore the central government in Baghdad, and if so, what effect that'll have?
Yeah, thanks. I think the Arab states, Saudi Arabia in the forefront, will deal with an Iraqi government, a Shiite-led Iraqi government, that will make serious compromises on the key issues that, you know, are called the benchmarks, the oil law, for example, but it's most importantly the federalism question. Well, both. And if this government does not do it or cannot do it because it's too weak, as it well may be, then I think that's right. And I think for the neighboring states, it will be more interesting to push local actors to the fore as surrogates, as the best alternative. It's not clear to me that the Americans have given up on the central government. There's still talk of meeting these benchmarks. We all know that these things are very difficult. You can impose deadlines, it's not going to make it happen that way. The oil law, you know, the most important part of the whole thing, is moving at a glacial pace. It seems to be totally stuck, in fact. And maybe what we need is new elections in Iraq, and a new sort of a new generation of indigenous Iraqi leaders will come up and replace, but I think it's a gradual process, it won't be a single election, the former exiles who have been in control and who are either Kurds or Supreme Council, who have either secessionist agendas or, in the case of the Supreme Council, have wacky schemes that will most likely tear up the country. Even the debate itself is tearing up the country. So these people need to be replaced over time. And then you may see the kinds of compromises, the kinds of laws, compromise laws that would allay the fears of countries like Saudi Arabia. And then I think there's nothing that would stop them from putting ambassadors in Baghdad, something they have not done, for example, and to start serious trade relations, diplomatic relations. So again, we're now, and we've been at this juncture at earlier times when we said, you know, it can go either way, but it's certainly looking bad. You know, it's still looking bad. I'm not an optimist in Iraq. I really am not, but I'd love to be. But I do recognize that we have a space now that could be used for good. And if it is not used for good, if it's used instead to support local actors at the expense of the central government, then I think Iraq is lost. And so that's why I'm so concerned when I started out my talk by saying, you know, the Awakening Councils, hey, they pushed Al-Qaeda out. Great, congratulations, good job, you know. But do we really want to empower these local actors at the expense of the powers of the central government? I mean, how far are we going to go with the decentralization? There's now a whole backlash in Iraq against decentralization. There's now, you know, a coalition forming that is against an extreme degree of decentralization, which the constitution has allowed. And, that coalition hasn't turned into an active policy-making coalition. It's only a coalition that has put its veto mark. It imposed this deadline for the provincial elections, very importantly. And so it's starting to come to the fore. And the question is, can these people be mobilized? Can the Alawi people, even the secular Sunnis and Shiites of Baghdad and other cities, can they come back somehow? Of course, most of them are in Amman and Damascus, and they're not coming back right now. But these are important constituencies that can keep Iraq together. Nobody's talking about getting back a regime that would over time turn into another tyranny, you know, that would be so heavily centralized, total control of oil resources, etc., etc. But we're talking about a degree of decentralization, but what we have now is so decentralized, and by default almost, and now being encouraged by the United States and by these Awakening Councils, like, you know, this is what we've got, these are our friends now, we got to work with them, the government is useless, you know, they're not spending their money outside Baghdad, even within Baghdad, so, you know, forget them. Very dangerous. I think you cannot afford to let the government fall away like that.
To ask that you follow my three rules, that first you identify yourself, second that until everybody's had a chance you only ask one question, and the third is that you ask your question in the form of a question, which is not to have a statement followed by what do you think. Thank you.
Jaap van Wezel with the Jerusalem Report in the Dutch news agency. I have a question about Iran. They must have a dilemma. On one hand, when the Americans are closer to the Sunnis, that is not an Iranian interest, that reduces Iranian influence. On the other hand, they are in favor of stability. You say they don't want the Americans out. How far does that go? To what extent are they interested in stability, and at what point they would like to undermine the Americans?
Well, they've been undermining the Americans, and they, I think, will continue to do so unless there is an agreement on the issue that is the most important, which is the nuclear question. And in the absence of that, I think Iran will continue to play the spoiler role. But it has a certain limit in what it can do for that very reason. If things spin out of control, this is not an Iranian interest. Now, there's some debate over whether Iran could live with a divided Iraq where it would control a Shiite region or country, whatever, entity, or it would not want that to happen. My view is that it would not want that to happen. Too many unpredictable factors in the breakup of Iraq. So they have an interest in keeping Iraq unified. If that is the case, then, of course, they have to be very careful what they do. So they will try to sabotage particular projects. And they have agents. They pay. They can do it. I don't think any of the Iraqi parties are an Iranian proxy. I don't think the Sadrists are. I don't think the Supreme Council even is. Even though they all get phone calls every day saying, could you, you need to do that. But they get phone calls from the Americans too, so they're always juggling. And so,
is there anyone that's not on the take from the Iranians?
Well, there's a lot of people on the take.
Right.
And there are groups, smaller groups on the take. But I wouldn't say the Sadrists are on the take. I wouldn't say the Supreme Council is on the take. Maybe elements within these parties. Maybe one day yes, another day no. From my experience, and I was in Iran in 2002 speaking to the Supreme Council, the distaste and dislike of the Iranians was palpable when you talk to these people. And Iranians talk down about the Arabs, it's a racial thing. So there's no love lost between these groups. But when push comes to shove, if the Shiites are pushed on the defensive, where will they go? Who is their protector? It's Iran. So that is there too. But I think the Iranians have to play a very careful game. And so, for example, now the status of forces agreement talks are starting, maybe next week. And there's a real concern on the part of the Bush administration that through the Sadrists, Iran will try to sabotage that. Will force a vote in the parliament, in the Iraqi parliament, on this. They don't want to vote in the parliament. They don't mind a debate in the parliament, but they don't want to vote in the parliament. The Sadrists could try to force a vote in the parliament and vote it down. So this is a real concern they have. And so it's in those ways. But would the Iranians unleash the resentment of the Iraqi people towards American forces by sort of causing some incidents that would create popular anger? Could be bomb attacks, in popular areas. There are lots of conspiracies that the Iranians are supporting Al-Qaeda, but this would only reinforce that. But never mind that. Would it do that? I think not at this stage. Not at this stage. I think that is a lever. They want to tell the Americans that they could do this when the time is there. And the time is there only when the Iranians are attacked. At the moment, it doesn't seem that that's going to happen. So I think we're steady state on this. We're not going to have the Iranians on the American side trying to rebuild the country and stabilize it. I think we're going to have a muddle through period for quite a long time.
Yeah. Samir Sumaidai, the Iraqi ambassador. Thank you for your analysis. If you permit me, I will not make a long statement, but just a comment.
Please.
Thank you. I don't share your level of pessimism. Clearly, we are not out of danger yet. If we look at the critical issue, can Iraq remain united as a single country? If the answer to that is yes, and it will, then a lot of things can be repaired with time and improved with time, solved with time. If not, then everything is possible. Now, on that specific issue, I want to ask you a question. The forces inside Iraq trying to pull it apart are very clear. But what I believe is underestimated are the forces which are trying to keep it together, both Iraqi and regional. Mm-hmm. Relating to this issue, in this country, in this city, there are policies being put forward for dividing Iraq, slicing it up. We've seen so many different plans and so many different proposals. These have an an impact on the ground. To what extent do you think these plans and ideas, including the Biden, so-called Biden amendment, which was passed in the Senate by a substantial majority, to what extent do you think they are misguided and harmful to Iraq? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Ambassador. But I think the debate has changed on this, or is changing, and it's because of the surge and the fact that it has, at least on the military front, has had this success, and it has reassured neighboring states that, in fact, the United States is committed to the unity of Iraq, whatever kind of system you have internally to arrange power. So I think that even Senator Biden, in drafting the text of the resolution that passed last year, had to water it down. And it doesn't talk about partition anymore. And it talks about, you know, degrees of decentralization and the need to be consistent with the constitution, for example, the Iraqi constitution. That has its own problems, but because the constitution is in part the problem that created the whole debate over federalism. But never mind that. So I think it is changing. I mentioned already a couple of things. One is this emerging coalition of Iraqis who are Iraqi nationalists and who are cross-sectarian. They're not all Sunnis or all Shiites, they're both. And who have a real stake in the country staying together. The Sadrists are an important element of that, and I've already mentioned that the Americans are now starting to reach out to the Sadrists, which I think you can say what you want about the Sadrists, and there are thuggish elements, and that's unfortunate, but you cannot get around these people. They are going to be an important part of Iraq's future. You need to work with them, and the better to moderate them, bring them in, than to try to defeat them and fail. But the Sadrists, you know, have profiled themselves as Iraqi nationalists. And you know, you talk to individual members and maybe, you know, you find out that they're just a sectarian as some of these other guys. But I think that is the foot soldiers, and they can be brought around over time. But the leadership seems to be quite intent on profiling itself as Iraqi nationalist. On the Sunni side, this is clearly, I mean, this has always been the ideology of the Sunnis, of Iraqi nationalism, of Arab nationalism. They want to keep the country together. So the Fadila party in Basra, even though it has some regionalism notions in Basra, not a Shiite region, but a Basra region, they are not thinking it the same way as the Kurds are about their region. And at heart, and if you look at the statements of their leader and the spiritual leader, they are talking about one Iraqi nation. So this is starting to come together, and it's really a backlash against the extreme regionalism that is sectarian and ethnically based of the Kurdish parties and of the Supreme Council. And I think really in the future what is going to be key is whether this ruling alliance that has governed Iraq, well, not governed very well, but has ruled Iraq for the last 3-4 years, the Kurdish parties and the Supreme Council, that close alliance that has basically been in charge of Iraq, can that be broken? Can it be weakened by this other alliance that is clearly a nationalist alliance, but that don't have a lot of other things in common? This is going to be the key change, and I think the one that is linked to that is the sort of the gradual replacement of the former exiles by Iraqis who never left and who have an entirely different outlook on things, who are quite clearly more Iraqi nationalist. And I know you are. I don't want to put you in that category, but and I know you're not, in fact. But there are a lot of the former exiles who are in the category where they're not with a unified Iraq.
Can I just ask on that question, because I think in the Palestinian community there's been a lot of hope that there would be a new generation of Fatah that would come of people who hadn't been in exile, who would be able to lead a more moderate compromise forward, and that hasn't worked. Or could you talk a little bit about this new generation, why you expect the outcome to be different?
Well, in terms of what the outcome would be different in terms of their outlook on what Iraq should be, in terms of whether it should be one country, or maybe it shouldn't be one country, or at least it should be a highly decentralized country. I think those notions don't exist among this group. And I really see it as a former exile versus never left Iraqi group. And it has, and the latter group is cross-sectarian, while the first group is Kurds and some Shiites, some Shiite Islamists, the Supreme Council. And if you look at if the electoral process proceeds more or less in a legitimate way, without anyone undermining the elections, you know, carrying out shenanigans, carrying out fraud, whatever, then these people can only start to outweigh the former exiles over time. But the former exiles have one great advantage, which is they've held power, and they control the institutions. The Supreme Council has been very good at mobilizing institutions to its own ends. And so it will continue to do that. It will do that for the provincial elections that are coming up as well. But the Sadrists who boycotted the previous elections are going to participate. And the Sunni Arabs who boycotted the previous provincial elections are going to participate. And so this is going to have an impact on the ground. And so the question really is how much? And that is going to be a very interesting question. And how will that translate over time into national power as well? And then, you know, we have the national elections coming up. But all of that assumes that the Americans will stay to help organize these elections, protect these elections. It will assume that the United Nations will take a greater role, providing technical assistance to the Electoral Commission and do election monitoring. All of those are critical elements.
There's a question against the wall. Do you still have, sir? Do you still have a question or not so much?
In 2006, and I know that President Bush, you know, raised the Samarra Shrine bombings as the turning point. For me, the turning point was the January 2005 elections and the coming to power of a government that had gained disproportionate power on an ethnic and sectarian basis because the other groups boycotted, both the Sunni Arabs and the Sadrists. So that is the turning point. That's when the civil war started, and it was triggered by people like Zarqawi, al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was bombing Shiite shrines and marketplaces and whatnot. The retaliation started, despite, say, Ayatollah Sistani's urgings for restraint, started after the Supreme Council took over the Interior Ministry in May of 2005 and was able to use government security forces to act as death squads and started, you know, having these torture centers that were, some of which were uncovered, etc., etc. This was the start of the civil war. The shrine bombings played an important role in accelerating that, in our view. Not the turning point, but an accelerating point where the Sadrists came out into the street and started, attacking Sunnis just in the streets and escalating the violence, sectarian violence. So that is what we had in 2006. A decision was taken, and I must say we were very skeptical of it as being a little too late in January 2007 to have a surge. And the surge was organized. General Petraeus was appointed to carry it out. It took several months to have a full deployment of forces. It was until June. Even then, it took another 2 or 3 months before the real impact of the surge became visible. It was after Petraeus' presentation in Congress in September of 2007. So we're only talking about several months ago that you could see a tangible improvement at the local level in Anbar and in Baghdad neighborhoods. And you know, you can talk to any Iraqi living in those areas. They will tell you, you know, things have dramatically changed for us, and it's because the Americans finally did the right thing. They pushed out al-Qaeda. They pushed out the Sadrists from the mixed neighborhoods. Of course, the Sadrists are very much still in the Sadrist neighborhoods, but the mixed neighborhoods. And so, this is where we are now. This, first of all, very psychologically, this gives hope to people. People lost hope. I remember talking to Iraqis in 2005. I was telling them, listen, there's a civil war that is upon you. They said, no. You know, they don't want to believe it. You don't want to believe such a thing. It's awful, of course. You don't want it to happen. So you close your eyes to all the signs, in a way. Then the Samarra Shrine bombings, what it did is it lifted those blinders of people's eyes, and they realized that, in fact, they were in the midst of a civil war. And suddenly the mood changed. Suddenly everybody was depressed, and you know, there was just no hope. The surge changed that again. People have hope again. This is psychologically very important because that means they're going to help you. And America, you can talk to Americans and say, you know, all the Iraqis are coming to us again. The intelligence gathering, it just gets much better suddenly, you know, very important. So they can carry out better raids, more targeted raids. They can avoid these raids that, you know, piss off a lot of people because they're not going after the right people, just kill, you know, people in their homes or humiliate them. So this is very important. And secondly, okay, now you've got these political actors and you've told them, listen, we're going to do this for you and we can help you. We're going to support you. You Sunnis, we're going to support you. We're going to give you training. We're going to give you some financial support. We may not give you weapons, but we'll allow you to carry your weapons because we know you have them. So now you can bring them out in the open and protect your neighborhoods. This is good for you. You want us to stay? Then you need to start talking to the other guys. And to the shared militias, they're saying the same thing. To the shared parties, Islamist parties, they're saying the same thing. Dawah and the Supreme Council and the Sadrists. Listen. Now it's time to talk. We're not going to stay forever. You know what will happen if we leave. You will fight again with these other guys. This is your chance. Now you've got to talk. Well, it's easier said than done. This is politics. It's going to take a long time. And this is why American military commanders are saying, you know, we cannot leave for any, you know, it's going to take years. Some are saying it's going to take a generation. Hello, I don't know politically how that's going to fly in the United States. That's a separate issue, or even with the overstretching of the military capabilities. These are professional issues. But this was the military saying that, and senior generals. So that's where we are. That is where the political space is, the breathing space. That's where, and now, and my only concern is that we're at the very end of the Bush administration. It's basically lame duck already. It clearly has not in no position to take major new initiatives. And paradoxically, or whatever, ironically, Petraeus has been so successful militarily that he's created enough stability to last until the November elections. So why expend political capital on something as uncertain as, you know, reconciling Sunnis and Shiites in Iraq? And so we may instead have probably, you know, an attempt to do as little as possible and to keep things calm until the November elections. Then the new president comes in. It's going to take time to get settled, get appointees going. So I don't expect any major political initiative. I'm not from here, so you know these things better than I do, but I don't expect anything until the summer of 2009. And then the question is what? It depends on the candidate.
John Iskander, State Department. And the question really has to do with the question of sectarian identity and to what extent this can be pushed back. I mean, it's clear, I don't know Iraq that well, but I mean, it's, you know, there's clearly a massive increase in that kind of identification and then all of the ramifications of that. And I think you're pointing to the elections, but even the CPA seems to me is implicit or complicit in creating the kind of sectarian politics and so on. And so now we have this on the ground. I mean, lots of Iraqis that, you know, I'm sure much better than I will say, oh, this isn't who we are, and that real desire to deny it and to be rid of it. What can happen structurally to change the reality? I mean, once the reality is out, how do you push it back? I mean, you're clearly addressing part of that with this kind of political alliances that you're talking about. Do you have other, it's not exactly recommendations, but as you look at this, what are the things that you see that might give one hope to think that, yeah, some of this can be pushed back and changed, if at all?
Well, you know, historically and comparatively, you know that these kinds of identities are pushed by political actors in order to gain territory, control power, whatever, resources. And so the same in Iraq. And you need to, in Iraq, to distinguish between sectarian identities and ethnic identities. The Kurdish question has been there for a very, very long time, and that's not going to go away. The Kurds will be Kurds. They have their own language, in fact, their own languages, but their own culture, their own traditions. They all have a shared sense of oppression by the central government. And so I want to put them aside for now, and they will be aside, in fact, territorially speaking and in terms of powers. The real problem is the sectarianization of Iraq, the emphasis on sectarian identity, Sunnis and Shiites. And these have been exploited by political actors, and I would say also that the CPA is partly to blame for that. It's not that these identities didn't exist. Of course, you know, you can go back to the original schism between Sunnis and Shiites. I mean, it exists, but it's not necessarily politicized, and there are long periods in history where these identities are irrelevant. And they were, until recently in Baghdad, especially in Baghdad and urban centers, relatively irrelevant. And intermarriage is huge among the Iraqi middle class, and even among others. So just as Kurds marry Arabs, and, you know, this is very, very common. So I think the good thing is now we have this I hate to call it a reversal, because I think that's going too far, but at least the freezing in place of what happened and a rollback of some of the worst aspects of what happened during 2006 and early 2007. And the mobilization of sectarian identities is a fairly recent phenomenon, and all the people who are so dead set against this are still alive and around, even if they live in Amman. And that's a serious problem. They're not in Iraq. But in Iraq also, there's still many, many. And we're doing interviews on an ongoing basis in Baghdad, and you get exactly the answer what you already said. You know, we are Iraqis, we're not Sunnis or Shiites. But they can't afford it. They would break up their marriages if they said these things. You know, they don't want to say these things. And then they're secular. This is something that has been driven by the religious parties. Now, the next elections will show how well, you know, people like these religious parties, how well they have governed, you know, and they haven't really governed. But they have a lot of institutional power that they have accumulated, and to dislodge them is going to be difficult. Even if they're unpopular, they may still win the elections. So this is where we are.
Thank you. Yasmin Adamri from the Saudi Press Agency. And I actually agree with you completely, because this difference in fighting between the sects is a completely a new idea, because I'm the child of an Iraqi Shi'i and an Iraqi Sunni, and I never knew the difference, honestly. I mean, it was good enough to be Muslim and Iraqi, and we're such a proud people that's, you know, good enough. And that was good enough until politics played a part. All that aside, I'm asking about what will it take to institute Arab nationalism, and with the inclusion of Iran, then Muslim nationalism, and to unite them, aside from, let's say, gaining economic wealth or something like that for the self-interest of the Gulf states. And what does it take for someone like Saudi Arabia, who is doing fairly well, has good relations with the United States, is economically doing well, and can take care of itself? Why would they want to become involved if it wasn't for the case of Arab nationalism or something like that?
Yeah, I think, you know, many things have happened since 2003, and one thing that has happened is that Arab nationalism has taken a real beating in Iraq. And, you know, look at the role of the Arab League. What role? There's no role. There you go. You know, that's just the evidence. And so we now cannot talk about Arab nationalism in Iraq without immediately alienating a very important, powerful constituency, which is the Kurds. They will not stand for it. It will be for them a basis for secession. Of course, they cannot secede, not now anyway. And so they will have to come to grips with some kind of accommodation. And I think that one of the upcoming battles really is about, you know, the territory and powers of the Kurds. This is why the United Nations is starting to focus on this. So that is one fault line. The other one is the religious one. You mentioned, include Iran. Well, then you can include the Kurds too, and even Turks. But then you get into another dangerous area, which is the whole secularism versus religion debate, which is very acute in Turkey, of course, which is very important to the Kurds. They have that debate within Kurdistan, but the Islamist parties are still fairly small, but are taking advantage of all the corruption and problems that are happening in Kurdistan as well. So that debate is really starting. And it's obviously a debate inside Iraq between the secular class, people who never saw a real distinction between Sunnis and Shiites, because we're all people and the religion doesn't matter, And the religious parties that have seized control really after 2003. So I don't think you're going to get a return of Arab nationalism at the same strength anytime soon. Is it the spent force? Maybe it's the spent force in the region. Again, the Arab League in the whole region has been ineffective, more or less. A couple of examples where you can say, okay, they played a role. But by and large, and this is so emblematic of what is happening in the region as such. And we're seeing the emergence of new fault lines, and we're far from having settled this. But there's no return as such to Arab nationalism that I can see, for better or for worse. Well, they cannot afford Iraq to fall apart, so they will take Iraq with whatever it will be. They may accept an Iraq that is ruled by a Shiite majority that is Arab, of course, but that is seen as Persian because under the Iranian sphere of influence. They may have to accept, a great degree of Kurdish autonomy, with the constitution reflecting that, as there are two peoples in Iraq, which, of course, even the constitution before 2003 also reflected to some extent, that Iraq is a country of at least two nations. So it may have to settle for that. And I think, that we need pragmatists to come around to that. But the key of it all is what kind of deals are going to be cut in Baghdad over the key questions of federalism. How do you split the pie? How do you cut the pie? Those are the key questions. That is where we need to see the real progress, and that's why I'm worried, because I'm not seeing it.
Ethan. Yes, hi, Ethan Chorin. I'm a senior fellow here with CSIS. I was wondering if you might be able to say something about the situation of Iraqi refugees in neighboring countries and whether the surge might have had any impact on to deal with this, with that crisis.
Yeah, I mean, potentially the Iraqi refugees are highly destabilizing to the neighboring states, and the neighboring states have been largely Jordan and Syria, to some extent Lebanon as well. Even the Gulf states, and even Egypt. But let's say Syria and Jordan have taken the brunt of it. But we have to be very careful about the numbers, for example. FAFO did a study in Jordan, which was was taken out of the hands of FAFO at an early stage in terms of who was the main interlocutor with FAFO. It wasn't the UNHCR, which was meant to be it. It became the Jordanian government. And if you look at the report that FAFO put out, it's a very interesting piece of writing, because on the one hand, it says they found only like 160,000 Iraqi refugees in Jordan, but that's somewhere hidden away. And then at the top it says, we agree with the Jordanian government that there are probably 400,000 or 500,000 Iraqi refugees, I forget the exact number, Iraqi refugees, and that's because the Jordanian government has calculated it such and such a way. Yeah, well, what about your calculations? When you go to FAFO's calculations, they come to a different conclusion, but they couldn't say that in the first few paragraphs. So it's a strangest document, and I find quite shameful to FAFO, actually, that they allowed their professionalism to be undermined this way. But never mind that. So the numbers, we have to be careful, it's probably not as many as some suggest. I was living in Jordan at the time, and you noticed that there was like all these cars. So this means already that the people who are coming can afford cars while they are refugees. That's significant. There were no refugee camps for Iraqis. Okay, some of the Iraqi refugees went into the Palestinian refugee camps in Jordan. Okay, fine, that happened in Syria as well. So in that sense, there are refugee camps, but that's anecdotal. That's not a serious number. So by and large, the Iraqi refugees have brought money into the economy. They've also driven up prices, of course. They've caused problems for ordinary Jordanians and Syrians. And the real long-term problem for them is that if they don't have an income, their family resources, so the extended family resources, are going to be depleting. You see already crime in Syria, prostitution, things like that. I think some of the people who did go back after the situation stabilized in Baghdad and other areas were exactly those people who were the hardest up and had absolutely no other source of income and needed to go back. But that's been a fairly small number. I'm worried about if the things start to deteriorate again, then do we get the real refugee flow? I mean, the real refugees, not the ones who can rent apartments in Amman and Damascus, but the ones who cannot. And with the policies of the Jordanians and Syrians already now being much stricter, where the Jordanians now have to, or the Iraqis who want to go to Jordan, for example, now have to get a visa in Baghdad from the Jordanian embassy rather than get it upon arrival, and then being turned back. And the whole flight of plane loads were being turned back by the Jordanians in the past year. Then you may get, if it's a total panic, if there's that kind of violence, you may get tent camps on the borders. We haven't seen that. So I'm worried about the future. I think the current situation is quite manageable. There's already an outflow to some extent to other Arab countries, even to Europe, not much, of course, certainly not to the United States, unfortunately. It's by and large, it's under control. The government's attracting funds to take care of it. Now, in both countries, the kids can go to school, public school. Syria was always possible. In Jordan, they've just allowed it as of last September. This is significant. There's some health benefits for some of them that can be improved. But that's a resource issue.
Bridget Brin from the British Embassy. I wonder if you could say something more about the opportunities and risks associated with provincial elections, and particularly how you see them translating into the national elections that are due to take place by the end of 2009.
I'm so glad nobody's asked me about the Gulf states yet. Anyway, the provincial elections, first of all, it was one of the Bush administration's benchmarks that the provincial elections take place early on. Why? Because the first set of provincial elections, as I already mentioned, in January 2005, experienced a boycott from two key actors, the Sunni Arab parties, which at that time hadn't congealed into real parties yet, and I know you were on the ground at the time, the Sadrists. And so that created an imbalance in a number of key areas. In Anbar, Sunni Arab area, there were hardly anybody stood for election, very few people voted. So one party won. It was the Iraqi Islamic Party, basically the political expression of the Muslim Brotherhood, which otherwise doesn't have a lot of support in Anbar. They're Sunni Arabs, but they're not that kind of Sunni Arabs. And I think a real struggle may come in the coming months between that party, which is beleaguered in Anbar, but which holds the provincial council for now, and these new awakening councils, the tribal forces, which hold real power in Anbar, will want to get that reflected through the elections. That's Anbar. But let's go to mixed areas. It played very deeply in mixed areas. Say, look at the Mosul, Nineveh Governorate Council, where the Sunni Arabs boycotted the elections, by and large, and you had a council made up entirely of Kurds and Shiites in Mosul. Now, there are Kurds living in Mosul, there are Shiites living in, obviously, somebody voted for them, they were there. But who are they? Well, in Mosul, you find some Shiite Turkmens in Tel Afar, and you find some the Shiite Kurds in Sinjar. Not a whole lot, but there are some. Otherwise, there are not a lot of Shiites in Nineveh that I can think of. Mostly it's Sunni Kurds, or Sunni Arabs, or Sunni Turkmens. The Kurds, there's a significant number of Kurds in Mosul city itself on the eastern side of the river, and in some of the outlying areas. Of course, in Sinjar itself, they're mostly Yazidis, but they're Kurds by and large. And so, but they've gotten a totally disproportionate control over the provincial council, and this has been highly destabilizing in Nineveh governorate. Baghdad, Supreme Council was very strong there, because the Sadrists didn't stand. But look at Sadr City, that is 2 million people, maybe, who knows, in the capital, who didn't vote. And if they were to vote, or maybe some of them did vote, but if they were to vote and had Sadrist candidates, that would be a tremendous setback against the fortunes of the Supreme Council. We have Basra as a Shiite city, with Sunni minority, but mostly a Shiite city now, which is totally divided between the three. Now there you have, you had actually elections, pretty much everybody participated, the Sadrists not in their own name, but under different guises. You had Fadila, you had Supreme Council. if now that power of the Supreme Council is going to be pushed back, probably, because they're not very popular, and the Sadrists, who haven't officially governed, may benefit from the fact that they didn't officially govern, meaning they didn't govern, because nobody governed, and therefore make some headway there. So all of this means is that if we're going to have this kind of reversal, then the parties that gained disproportionate power in the January 2005 elections are going to resist this tooth and nail, if they can. And if they cannot resist it, they're going to try to manipulate these elections to be so that they become to their maximum benefit. I didn't mention Kirkuk, but Kirkuk, of course, critical battleground for the Kurds versus the Arabs and Turks. I mentioned it earlier. So this means that, if the United States, with the help of the United Nations, proceeds to organize serious elections, and with the Iraqi Electoral Commission, of course, serious elections, and the help of the Iraqi government, all of that, and the security forces, in, say, October 2006, what am I saying, 2008, then you can expect these parties to find other ways to control the institutions, either to commit fraud, or I'm not saying that, you know, but this is something that we need to look out for. I'm not saying that they're intending to commit fraud, or to use their institutional power to create the kinds of lists that are already favorable to their party interests, and that's essentially what happened in 2005 as well. So we need to see what electoral system we're going to have. It's a fairly short day; it's only, you know, 6-7 months away. And then we come to the December 2009 elections at the, for the Council of Deputies, and that's I think much is going to be. We need to look at the outcome of the provincial elections before we can make any kind of determination about the national elections. But I would like to think that some of these local leaders are going to be able to translate their local power into national power to become deputies, and then again this will be resisted. But then the electoral system is going to be key. Now, I'm not an electoral specialist, and I always get completely confused when talking about it, so maybe I shouldn't. I will. In fact, I won't. But if you have... But if you're going to have another district-based system, as we did in 2005, then you may get the kind of sort of closed lists that that we had then with the Supreme Council, by its institutional power, by its military power, by its political power, basically saying, we're at the top of the list. And so we're going to be able to appoint our people to the key positions. That, I think, would be very, very negative. We need to have another electoral system. Now, there was a debate in 2004 about what electoral system should we have. And basically, people went to the default mode where, you know, the only thing that could, the only system that was viable in the time available to organize these elections was the system that we ended up with. But now we have time. And so this is the opportunity to change that.
Speaking of time, I think we have time for about one more question if somebody has something urgent. Philo
Dibble from CNO Resources. You mentioned that there are some in the U.S. military who are tempted to apply the Anbar model, as it's come to be known, elsewhere in Iraq, and your reference to it suggested that you didn't think that was such a great idea.
That's right.
Could you say more about why not?
Okay. First of all, I think it's a very dangerous thing to start empowering tribes anywhere. They are notoriously actors with parochial agendas who will have a very hard time gathering around a national agenda. And if we're talking about, you know, Arab nationalism and keeping the country together, empowering tribes is not going to do it. I think empowering tribes is useful if you want to throw out Al-Qaeda. There they've got something going. They want to take revenge on these people because Al-Qaeda was a very nasty actor, not only to the Shiites, but also in the areas where they were lording it around over other people. Especially the tribes. The tribes were using all their young people to Al-Qaeda. The old guys all, you know, decamped to Amman, and the mid-level leaders, sheikhs, they either went with Al-Qaeda or were killed or, you know, were living in fortresses. And so this was their opportunity to fight back, and they did it. Congratulations to them. I think, well done. But now, where else does this apply? In Diyala, it doesn't apply, really. The tribal system is not the same in Diyala. And the tribes themselves are much more mixed, Sunni and Shia. And already, that's, I think, why in Diyala we haven't actually seen real progress yet in terms of pushing Al-Qaeda back. Ba'aquba has become marginally safer. Al-Qaeda is out of the city itself, but it's still on the outskirts and it's still capable of launching attacks, as we have seen. It may work in Nineveh, but there I should say that there's already a lot of resistance against this whole notion of awakening councils from the Kurds. The Kurds don't want it because because the Arabs are agreeing to do these things in order to help the Americans, but the quid pro quo is pressure on the Kurds. So the Kurds don't want it. That is sensible from their point of view. So it's already and Nineveh and Ta'amim are key areas for them. And then the south, the question is, okay, what was the point of the Awakening Council? It was to push back Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is not in the south. Who is in the south? The Sadrists. The Sadrists. But what should be the policy toward the Sadrists? This is where I come to the difference between Al-Qaeda and the Sadrists. These are radically different movements with radically different agendas, and they should be therefore treated in radically different ways. And what works in one place against Al-Qaeda is not going to work in another place against Al-Sadr. And in fact, even if it does work, it's not, well, I don't think it will work. But anyway, it's the wrong thing to do. The Sadrists need to be brought into the political system. And that is the challenge. And so you don't need more Shiite militia, tribal, in this case, tribal militias, when we already have too many Shiite militias.
A huge amount of food for thought, and I think one of the most sort of integrated views I've heard of Iraq, because you really did a wonderful job tying the local politics in with all of the external forces. I think I speak for all of us. And I want to thank you for coming by and talking to us today, and hope you have a wonderful rest of your trip to Washington.
Thank you very much. Thank you.